books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today, in a show recorded on location at Dumfries House in Ayrshire at the Boswell Book Festival, I speak to Frances Wilson about her book Electric Spark, The Enigma of Dame Muriel Spark. Plus, Adam Hart tells me about his book Operation Pimento. Plus, we'll find some new books and some musical biographies in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
After her book Electric Spark, The Enigma of Muriel Spark, was recommended more than once on Books of My Life by a number of different authors, I was delighted to run into the author Frances Wilson at the Boswell Book Festival. She is an English author, academic and critic, best known for writing prize-winning, unconventional biographies and some literary history. Her popular books include How to Survive the Titanic, Guilty Thing, A Life of Thomas de Quincey, and Electric Spark, The Enigma of Dame Muriel, which we discussed at Boswell. Let's first hear from the audio version, though, which is narrated by Sarah Vickers.
I was born on the first day of the second month of the last year of the First World War, a Friday. Spark wrote in an amusette called The First Year of My Life. Muriel Sarah Camberg, as she was then named, knew from the moment she drew breath that 1918 was the worst possible year for her autobiography to begin, because she was a transmitter, able to tune in from her cot in Edinburgh to scenes and conversations from around the globe. Every newborn, she explained, is an omniscient narrator, blessed or cursed, with an all-knowingness that in most cases, but not her own, is brainwashed out by the time we walk and talk. When she was 10 days old, Tsar Nicholas II appeared on her frequency, telling his wife that nothing would ever induce me to sign the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Age 15 days, she received news about the German spring offensive. Speeding through the wave bands, she caught the intonations of George Bernard Shaw and Joseph Conrad, the playboy of the Western world, at London's Court Theatre, Picasso's marriage to Olga Kochlova, and Virginia Woolf yawning. Aged 6 months, the Romanovs' descent to the basement of Ipatiev House was transmitted to her live. The First Year of My Life, written for The New Yorker in 1975, was dispatched with the light and satirical touch that Spark applied to all those subjects she took most seriously. She may not have been full radio mast, but she clearly had superpowers. She was in no doubt about this. She was aware from the start of a definite something beyond myself, an access to knowledge that I couldn't possibly have gained through normal channels, including a sixth literary sense, possessed only by certain readers and critics.
Electric Spark is the life of the novelist Muriel Spark until 1960. She was born in 1918, so it's the first half of her life. She died in 2006. So it's about her evolution as a novelist. It's about the turbulence of her life in advance of becoming a novelist in the late 50s.
The image of herself as a wireless set took hold when she was five, and her brother built one from a clump of metal and a whisker of wire. Soon afterwards, Muriel went to a matinee show with her Aunt Gertie, where a performer called Florrie Ford reclined glittering in the middle of the stage beside an enormous wireless set with multicoloured, illuminated valves, which looked like light bulbs. Resting on one elbow while twiddling the knobs, Florrie Ford sang a song called Dream Daddy. There is a moment in every childhood, said Graham Greene, when the door opens and lets the future in. Spark remembered this performance because the woman controlling the radio waves was the artist she would one day become.
Now tell us about the structure of the book, because you start off with Muriel Spark sending out sparks.
She sent out sparks all the time. So the book is structured into... It's framed around her invitation to a man called Martin Stannard, who was not her first biographer, but her second biographer. Her invitation to him in 1993 to write her biography. Her first biographer had been called Derek Stanford, and he was in the 60s. And the names are very similar, Derek Stanford and Martin Stannard. And even she got them confused. And so I was interested in the relationship between Muriel Spark and her first biographer and second biographer. And both biographies went very wrong. I mean, she fell out very badly with her second biographer. And it was her relationship with him that intrigued me. And I thought, you know, I want to explore why she invited a stranger into her life to write a biography when she had just herself written her memoir. And so she told the version of her life she wanted the world to see anyway. So why put the fox amongst the chickens?
To be born in Edinburgh is no mean start. It was also the birthplace of Walter Scott and Robert Louis Stevenson. James Boswell was born there too, which makes it the cradle of modern biography. And James Hogg, literary shepherd, made the city his home and entered its bloodstream. The Edinburgh character, which can be imbibed from what Spark called its informed air, is severe, self-governing, satirical, superstitious, and steeped in the supernatural. Spark had an Edinburgh attitude, an Edinburgh temperament, an Edinburgh way of seeing things. Edinburgh people, she said, were either sane, eccentric, or plain mad. They were not neurotic.
Was the version of Muriel Spark that Muriel Spark put out an accurate portrayal?
Well, it was... She called her memoir Curriculum Vitae. She always wrote very close to the title. Her titles were always canny and humorous in various ways. And what we all know about Curriculum Vitae is that they're full of gaps. When we've all written a CV, it's kind of what we haven't put in that's really important. And so I read Curriculum Vitae between the lines. And she ended the book at the point where she became a novelist in the late 50s as well. And so my biography of her was structured very much around Curriculum Vitae. I ended at the point that she ended it. But no, I think she left all sorts of things out of Curriculum Vitae, and she put all sorts of things into Curriculum Vitae that weren't essentially true either.
Samuel Johnson, passing through Edinburgh on his Scottish tour, dismissed it as too well known to admit description. But he described it nevertheless as a place that would make a good prison in England. The Scottish writer Lewis Grassic Gibbon compared it to a disappointed spinster with a hare lip and inhibitions. And Daniel Defoe thought it presented the effect of one vast castle. In no other city on earth do so many people live in so little room. Built on volcanic rock, protected by a fetid loch, bordered by crags and enclosed by walls, Edinburgh grew not outwards but upwards in 15-storey tenements known as lands, the world's first high-rises, and downwards in tunnels and vaults. The lands, their stairways straight as ladders, were so enormously stretched up, as Coleridge put it, they might be reflections on the polished back of a Brobdignac spoon held lengthways. The occupants, piled on top of one another, came from every social class, with shopkeepers on the lower stories and lawyers, nobles and ministers up above. The alleys between the lands were called wynds, or closes, and in one of these, commemorated now as Brodie's Close, lived William Brodie. Cabinet maker by day, housebreaker by night. Brodie was hanged a century and a half before Muriel was born, at the old tollbooth on gallows of his own devising.
Now, we've heard clips through the magic of editing of Sarah Vickers reading the audiobook. Were you responsible for Sarah's casting in any way?
Yes, I chose her. I wanted someone who had exactly the right voice, because it's about, Muriel Spark was all about voice, and she was very interested in voice. She talked about herself as having an auditory imagination. She heard voices, and she said that her novels came to her through voices in the air. She was fascinated by radio. She'd have loved the whole idea of audiobooks, and her novels are all about the catching of voice. You don't see anything in a Spark novel, but you hear a great deal. She caught everyone's mannerisms. And so the importance of voice was absolutely vital for me. So we went through a lot of voices before finding the right voice for the audiobook, and I think it's perfect, yes.
Do you not fancy doing it yourself?
Absolutely no, I couldn't do it. It's such a precise voice she had, because it was the kind of Morningside accent with which she'd had elocution lessons, which made it slightly Queen's English, but she never lost her trace of Morningside, which came on quite strong apparently when she was annoyed. And so no, I couldn't do it myself.
In 1876, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote a play called Deacon Brodie, or The Double Life. And in 1929, Miss Jean Brodie, Spark's metaphor for Edinburgh, claimed to be descended from Willie Brodie, a man of substance, a night burglar only for the sake of the danger in it. It is the stuff I am made of. In the late 18th century, when the High Heepit Citadel, as the poet and occultist Lewis Spence called the Old Town, had reached bursting point, a new town was planned on the other side of the loch. It would conform to a simple grid scheme with elegant open squares, drafty parallelograms, according to Henry James, and a central thoroughfare called Princes Street. The loch was drained and Princes Street Gardens planted in the ravine, where the station was built in the mid-19th century. When the trains arrive and depart, the gardens still tremble and shake. The new town was Edinburgh's Enlightenment front, and the old town her buried self.
Now, I have a section in the show where I ask for book recommendations. I might ask you for some in a minute, but that book, Electric Spark, has been recommended quite a lot in the last year or so, even by American authors and people you wouldn't think would have a relationship with the works of Muriel Spark. What's her appeal both nationally and internationally?
Oh, that's interesting. I think one of the things that must be appealing about her is she doesn't age. You don't feel when you're reading a Muriel Spark novel that you're reading a novel of the mid-20th century. Her last novel was the early 21st century, but it doesn't feel in any way dated. She wrote young all the time, and she's still ahead of the time. I mean, the novels still feel kind of ludicrously fresh and buoyant. And so that clearly must be an appeal that we haven't quite caught up with her yet. And she was full of fun and games, and we haven't even begun to explore the amount of traps she left for the reader. And so I think it's not that we've finished with her, we haven't quite started with her.
Would you have been one of Miss Brodie's elite?
Oh, of course I would have loved to have been one of Miss Brodie's elite. I think I wouldn't have been, because I was too shy. I was too shy at school, and I wasn't at all shining when Muriel was so dazzling at school. She was so good at being at school. She loved institutions. She loved school as an institution. She wrote about institutions like the May of Tech Club. Girls all living together. And I'm really bad inside institutions. I just kind of fade away. So no, sadly, I would not have been there.
The city's Janus face was the subject of Robert Louis Stevenson's novella, Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which evolved after a fever dream from his play about the double life of William Brodie. South of the old town, across a park called the Meadows and the Brunsfield Links golf course, are the Victorian villas and tenements where the prime of Miss Jean Brodie is set, and where Muriel Camberg was born, in a rented flat on the first floor of 160 Brunsfield Place, on the 7th anniversary of her parents' marriage.
Electric Spark, The Enigma of Muriel Spark by Frances Wilson is available commercially as an ebook in print and in audio narrated by Sarah Vickers. It's the Sarah Vickers version that's also available from RNIB. And Frances will be back at the end of today's show for Books of My Life. But now, let's head to RNIB Library to find some musical biography.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Penguin Random House recently gave us Hope I Get Old Before I Die, How Rock's Greatest Generation Kept Going to the End by David Hepworth.
On the evening of 13th of July 1985, when Paul McCartney was brought before the crowd at London's Wembley Stadium in order to close the British end of the Live Aid fundraiser to help relieve famine in Ethiopia by singing his 16-year-old anthem Let It Be, he was greeted in the manner of a venerable ancient briefly stepping down from rock's notional Mount Rushmore in order to bestow his blessing on the kids who were gathered that day, largely for old times' sake.
This is the story of how enduring rock icons like Pink Floyd, Bruce Springsteen and many more have remained in the ever-changing music game. When Paul McCartney closed Live Aid in July 1985, we thought he was rock's grand old man. He was 43 years old. As the 40 years since have shown, he and many others of his generation were just getting started. This was the time when live performance took over from records. The big names of the 60s and 70s exploited the age of spectacle that Live Aid had ushered in to enjoy the longest lap of honour in the history of humanity, continuing to go strong long after everybody else had retired. Hence, this is a story without precedent, a story in which Elton John plays a royal funeral, Mick Jagger gets a knighthood, Bob Dylan picks up the Nobel Prize, the Beatles become of anything bigger than the Beatles, and it's beginning to look as though all of the above will, thanks to the march of technology, be playing Las Vegas forever.
At the time, it seemed faintly ridiculous to regard a veteran like McCartney as being in the same bracket as the relative youngsters who had planned the day. In fact, he had only recently celebrated his 43rd birthday. On the 25th of June 2022, when the same Paul McCartney was introduced to an even larger crowd at the Glastonbury Festival in Somerset and simultaneously to the watching millions on TV, an occasion he instigated by singing his 58-year-old composition Can't Buy Me Love, or at least singing along with the crowd, who seemed wholly familiar with the words, despite the fact that only a minority of them had been born when it was released, he was seized on as one of the few things a 21st century festival audience who had grown up in a wilderness of specialisms and subcultures could possibly be expected to agree upon. This occasion took place only a week after he had celebrated his 80th birthday. This time, there was no thought of apologising for the years. This time, the years were the point.
Hope I Get Old Before I Die, How Rock's Greatest Generation Kept Going to the End by David Hepworth is read by the author and runs for 10 hours and 44 minutes.
New in the library, we have Songbird, an intimate biography of Christine McVie by Leslie Ann Jones. It was donated to us by Bonnier.
A white weatherboard millhouse leans beside the Little Star River, keeping watch over the village of Wickenbrew. Across a picturesque green with its 13th century flint-built church of St. Andrew, green-shuttered manor house and grand Queen Anne rectory, lurks an ancient timber-framed alehouse known as The Rose.
Christine McVie was a quintessentially English rock star, as both the backbone and the beating heart of Fleetwood Mac. As famous for their occasionally life-threatening decadent lifestyles as for their musical brilliance, they were held together by this strong, constant figure whom they dubbed the mother of the band. It was Christine who contained the flock and always got them back on track, and yet her personal life was every bit as tempestuous as those of her bandmates, weathering affairs, divorce, addiction and fiery passion, all which bled into her now iconic songwriting. Told by an author who herself was friends with Christine and with new contributions from those who knew her best, Songbird offers a true insider's view and a deep psychological insight into Christine as both a woman and a musician, the ultimate picture of a rock legend and a national treasure.
The Homely Inn, like the medieval Kentish village itself, is a quaintly photogenic refuge. Locals, walkers and occasional sightseers head here to sup and dine, to toast birthdays, weddings and funerals, to rejoice and to mourn, to ponder time both spent and yet to come. Creaking beams, wood floors and spitting log fires heave with fragments of the bygone and the blown. The prevailing mood is cosy, if a little restless. Non-villagers here are en route to somewhere else. Not all of them could tell you where they're heading. At a time in her life when she had burned bridges and turned her back on her bandmates to make a new home in this tucked-away place, Christine was a frequent visitor to the Rose. She dropped in every day, give or take at one point, around lunchtime or during the early evening, in need of human contact, as well as sustenance, and for want of anything better to do.
Songbird, an intimate portrait of Christine McVie, by Leslie Ann Jones, is read by Lucy Traeger and runs for 9 hours and 50 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
On the 14th of August 1943, Adam Hart's great-grandfather, Frank Griffiths, took off from RAF Tempsford on a secret midnight mission, codenamed Operation Pimento, but they were shot down near Annecy in southeast France. Only Frank survived. Though seriously injured, Frank felt it was his duty to get back to England to continue the fight. He embarked on a perilous 1,200-mile, 180-day escape across Europe via the attic of a brothel, a French woman's chimney, and a Spanish prison cell. 79 years later, Frank's 22-year-old great-grandson, Adam Hart, retraced the epic escape through France, Switzerland and Spain. His emotional encounters with descendants of people who'd risked their lives to help his great-grandfather reveal the enduring legacy of the operation and how we should never forget their sacrifice. Operation Pimento is not only a riveting true story, but also a vivid account of one young man's journey to discover more about a man he'd never met, but always knew to be a hero. The book is read by its author, Adam Hart.
Frank Griffiths died in 1996, 4 years before I was born. Although I never got to meet my great-grandfather, I have heard stories from his life so many times that I feel as though I know him. He is a family legend, a mythical presence whose crisp RAF uniform and daring flying exploits left a heavy impression on me as a boy. My earliest memories are of my grandmother Tessa talking about her father around the kitchen table in Big House Farm, Carmarthenshire. Between mouthfuls of Sunday lunch, Granny would tell me how Frank used to fly so low the belly of his aircraft would clip the trees. And when he went missing over Europe, she and her mother did not know whether he was alive or dead for 3 months. It was this story that captured my imagination as a teenager. Frank's three-month escape in the autumn of 1943 had the ingredients of a screenplay written by Lord Flashart himself. The tale differs between the storytellers, however. Characters are confused, details forgotten, and loose ends left untied. This is partly what inspired me to retrace Frank's arduous escape, to find out exactly what happened. But there were other reasons.
So my book's called Operation Pimento, and it's the story of my great-grandfather's escape in the Second World War after he was shot down in France and was the only survivor of the plane crash. It's also the story of my retracing of his journey from the crash site in the Alps to Gibraltar, and it sort of weaves the two stories together.
My generation is the first one unable to hear their ancestors' war stories firsthand. Our understanding of the Second World War is naturally shrinking. By recreating Frank's journey and writing about it, I hope to prevent his remarkable story from slipping into obscurity while paying homage to my childhood hero, one of the many incredible men and women who fought for the life we enjoy today.
Obviously, the landscape 79 years later has changed a bit, but was some of it the same? Could you picture them there?
Yeah, some places don't change that much, like farms, for example, are quite good for not changing. Mountains, you know, it's the Pyrenees are still the Pyrenees, which he hiked over. So obviously is a physical appreciation of his journey that I was able to make there. And of course, the best part really was the descendants of the French people who saved him. Meeting those descendants, their families are still there, often in the same areas. So yeah, they're still there, and meeting them was just such a wonderful part of the journey.
On a hot August evening in 1943, seven men strolled across an RAF airfield in rural Bedfordshire. The heat had gone out of the day, and the summer air of England was refreshing, if a little heavy with anticipation. The airmen were walking towards their Halifax, a four-engine heavy bomber, but stopped when they heard the other Halifaxes of 138 Squadron. They watched them taxi into position, surge down the runway, and rise into the amber sky. Each aircraft faced an uncertain future flying over Hitler's Europe, from the fjords of Norway to the foothills of the Pyrenees, and the plains of the Low Countries to high alpine plateaus. Meanwhile, beneath them, men and women of resistance groups were gathering with signal torches in hand, hiding themselves in hedges, dikes, cattle sheds, and forests, where they listened for the sound of friendly engines. The seven airmen clambered into their Halifax over Orange. At 9:40 p.m., the pilot, my great-grandfather Frank Griffiths, opened the throttle. The heavy bomber's four engines roared, the aircraft surged forwards, and 40 seconds later, Ophir Orange parted from English soil.
So it's as much about his adventure as the people he met along the way?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely, yeah. I think it was really the meeting of the people who inspired me to actually write the whole thing down, because it was just such a lovely, heartwarming, overwhelming sort of experience to meet them all. And I mean, of course, the Frank is the main character, but like those people were risking far more than he ever was, really, in a way, as civilians. So it's really about them and their bravery and what they were risking to do to help him. And that came out in meeting their descendants of how unbelievably proud they were of their ancestors, actually more proud than I was of Frank, in a way, which I found interesting.
What was the riskiest situation Frank got himself into?
God, there are so many, literally. I mean, surviving that plane crash was obviously incredible, and his whole crew and five civilians killed. But, I mean, if I had to... That wasn't obviously of his making. I think of his making probably be this one story of when he was flying a Walrus seaplane in the Irish Sea in tandem with a submarine and testing something, and at the end of the testing he landed on the sea next to the submarine, went down for lunch on the submarine, had a nice boozy lunch, came back up and realised that the sea had got choppy and the swell had blown up, and rather than be towed back to the shore, he decided to ask the submarine to steam off into the wind and bash the seas flat, and he would chase behind the submarine in his seaplane and get airborne before he crashed into the back of it, which he just about managed. But honestly, there are too many to choose from. That's just one I like.
Now, obviously, you would have known this as a family story. What made you retrace the steps?
So, yeah, as you say, it's a family story. So I'd always kind of grown up hearing it. I was always aware of it, despite never meeting Frank. But the catalyst actually for going out and doing it was I won a travel journalism bursary at university and went out with this idea to go and retrace Frank. And that's really how the journey came about. But that journey was going to be for one 1,000-word article. So it got a little bit out of hand and became this book through a series of happy coincidences, which, as I said before, was really the reason why I actually wrote it all down in the end was because the meeting with these French, meetings with the French people out there, that was just so special to me that that was what moved me to actually write it all down. But it all came from that bursary actually at the end of university.
Glancing out of his cockpit, Frank watched the exhaust fumes of the outer port engine change to white before dying altogether. This was not the first scrape the skipper had been in. He called up his flight engineer, certain it was petrol trouble, fixable by switching over the fuel tanks. But he received no reply. He called again. More silence. Frank ordered his dispatcher to jettison their load and weighed up his options. He wanted to be near water in case of a forced landing. That meant Lake Geneva, 25 miles north in the safety of neutral Switzerland, or Lake Annecy, which, although only a few miles behind him, was firmly in occupied France. The skipper bellowed for his flight engineer to contact him as scenarios raced through his mind. Three engines might be enough to coast to Switzerland, thought Frank, so he set course for Lake Geneva, his leg aching from applying right rudder. But with a terrible shudder, the Halifax's port engine conked out and the aircraft jerked violently. Ophir Orange locked herself in a permanent left-hand turn, and what little altitude she had began to dwindle.
Now, through the magic of editing, the listeners will have heard clips of the audiobook read by you. How was that process?
That was fascinating and exhausting. I'm sure lots of people probably say that, but yeah, it was intense 2 days, sat in a really warm, windowless box, not moving a muscle or even allowing your tummy to rumble or anything, just reading it, which is exhausting. It's really, really tiring. Just tiring on your throat, but also mentally tiring. And it also makes you realise how you don't actually write books to be spoken aloud. You write them to be read. And sometimes you read a sentence and I think, God, who on earth wrote this crap? You know, it's like, although especially the speech, it makes you realise how difficult speech is to write in a book, dialogue. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was fascinating.
Buildings leaped up below each wing. A church spire whizzed past, its tiles twinkling in the starlight. The skipper racked his mind for a solution. Parachuting was impossible. The aircraft was travelling at 90 miles per hour and with less than 100 feet of altitude. They'd be obliterated before even pulling the ripcord. With the smell of burning petrol thick in the air, he ordered the crew to crash stations and screamed at the flight engineer to change the fuel tanks. The second pilot, who'd been wrestling furiously with the escape hatch, finally succeeded in jettisoning it. But it was only a matter of seconds now. He gripped the yoke hard and braced for the terrible impact he knew was coming but could do nothing about. The flight engineer's voice finally crackled over the radio. "Okay, skipper, you're on 1 and 3 tanks now." Petrol surged through the fuel lines. The ground drew closer.
With thanks to Adam Hart, Operation Pimento, My Great-Grandfather's Great Escape, is available commercially in audio as read by the author. And before we return to Frances Wilson for the books of her life, let's take another trip to the RNIB Library.
The Woman in Suite 11 by Ruth Ware was given to us by Simon & Schuster.
When I walked into the bedroom, I sucked in my breath. The room looked like a bomb had hit it. Overturned drawers, duvet and pillows tumbled on the floor, a little side table upside down on the bed, and chairs strewn around like someone had been bowling with them, knocking them over like ninepins. There were clothes everywhere, on the carpet, on the bedside table, hanging off the window blind. I could barely even see the rug for the mess. In the middle of all of it was Delilah, my elderly tabby cat, washing herself placidly on top of a tumbled pile of what had been clean and folded laundry a couple of hours ago. There were only two possible explanations. One, I'd been burgled in the night by someone searching for something with a frightening level of determination, or two, Judah had let the boys dress themselves for school, and this was the result. and I was pretty sure I knew which one it was. Sighing, I picked up the chairs, retrieved Teddy's sippy cup from under his toddler bed, and shooed Delilah off the crumpled pile of washing. Then I began stuffing Eli's clothes back in his chest of drawers.
"You're awesome," said a little hoodie lying across the rug, complete with an appliqué dinosaur roaring.
Why didn't adult clothes have affirmations like that? There were days when I felt like I needed the boost of a smiley T-Rex saying he believed in me, and today was one.
The stunning mountain views, the beautiful shore of Lake Geneva, the terrified woman held in the suite belonging to the hotel's millionaire owner. Lo Blacklock's all-expenses trip to a luxury Swiss chateau should have been the ideal return to work, but as her past catches up with her, the millionaire's mistress demanding that Lo help her escape, and a body turning up in the room next door, forces Lo to ask how far would she go to help someone she's not even sure she can trust.
How was the interview?
Judah pulled off his headphones and looked up from his laptop as I set the sippy cup down on the kitchen counter. I never failed to get a lift walking into the main room of our apartment. It was what sold it to us in the first place. It's long, almost the whole length of the old tenement, with a dark polished wood floor and tall windows overlooking the neighbours' rooftops, and today it was full of low autumn sunshine and sparkling dust motes. When we bought the place, it had two bedrooms, and we'd used one for ourselves and kept the other for an office guest room. But then I got pregnant, and the office had become first a nursery and then the bedroom of two little boys. Now we worked, well, Judah worked, mostly from the kitchen table, in a little alcove off the side of the main living space. He'd been deep in a Zoom call when I got back, but now he had the air of someone very willing to be distracted. I shook my head. Okay, but I don't think I'll get it. The girl who interviewed me was really nice, but she told me I was overqualified. Twice.
Translation? They don't think they can afford you, Judah said with a shrug.
He pushed his reading glasses up on his forehead.
I told you, you should be aiming higher.
It's all very well to say that, but I've been out of the game a long time. I was trying not to let the irritation spill over into my voice, but I wasn't sure I was succeeding. It was easy for Judah to talk. He'd walked into a cushy staff post at the New York Times, of all places, right before the pandemic hit. He'd won the journalist equivalent of the lottery, and the fact that he knew it didn't make it any easier for me to stop comparing our career trajectories.
The Woman in Suite 11 by Ruth Ware is read by Imogen Church and runs for 15 hours, 11 minutes.
One Night at the Chateau by Veronica Henry was given to us by Orion.
I'd been in my pyjamas for 3 days when my godmother phoned. I didn't answer. Liz May didn't believe in pyjamas. She thought they belonged on men and children. She used to float about the kitchen in a pale pink negligee, as she put the mocha pot on the stove and gathered baguette and unsalted butter and apricot jam to put on the table outside for a summer breakfast. If I shut my eyes, I could smell her perfume mingled with the scent of coffee. Givenchy. She bought me my first bottle of perfume for my 14th birthday. She took me to Paris and let me choose my own. That's the kind of godmother she was. But as I looked at her name on the screen, I felt ashamed. Not just because of what I was wearing, but because I hadn't seen her for so long. When was it? Over 5 years ago, when she came over for Mum's funeral. I'd embraced her, holding her tight and breathing her in, and felt her tears on my cheeks. "Come and see us," she said, holding tightly onto my arms and looking into my eyes. "I'd love that," I replied. I meant it, but I didn't go. My other half, Daniel, was convinced she didn't like him. "She doesn't think I'm good enough for you," he said. He only thought that because she spoke to me in French when she didn't want him to hear what she was saying. She had the measure of him, certainly. "And that chateau's a bit of a pigsty." "It's shabby chic," I protested. Daniel just looked at me with his trademark sardonic eyebrow. His idea of a shower was one with 17 different settings, even better if it pumped out aromatherapy steam. There was no place in his life for temperamental sanitary ware, and the bathrooms at Chateau Villette were not their selling point. You went there for the ambience, not the ensuite. Thinking of showers made me wonder when I'd last had one. I couldn't remember. I sighed and tried to heave my heavy limbs off the bed. I considered it an achievement that I was on it rather than in it. Yesterday, I'd rolled up my pyjama bottoms, put on a trench coat, and made it to the corner shop, where I'd bought a tin of Jolly Green Giant, a packet of strawberry laces, and a can of Diet Coke. I'd eaten the corn kernels one by one, picking them out with my fingers. Each one felt like swallowing a rock.
Over the last few months, Connie's whole world has fallen apart. Her husband's run off with another woman, the magazine she works for has gone bust, and she's having to sell the family home. So when her beloved godmother, Lizmay, begs her to help run the beautiful Chateau Villette, it couldn't come at a better time. No one knows the chateau quite like Connie. She spent a blissful summer there in her 20s, learning to cook delicious French food for the guests, ironing the lavender-scented sheets, and trying to resist the very handsome neighbour, Remy. As soon as she arrives, it's clear that the chateau is close to crumbling, and Connie knows she's going to have her work cut out. Could it be the fresh start she didn't even know she needed? And will she find a way to save the chateau before it's too late?
I wonder what Lizmay wanted. Perhaps she was in London. Half of me longed to see her, to meet her for lunch at her favourite restaurant, 45 German Street, then wander around Piccadilly for all the things she wanted to take back to France. Soap from Santa Maria Novelli, Fortnum's tea, books from Hatchard's. The other half of me wanted to hide, because if I answered, I'd have to tell her the truth, and then it would become real, and I'd have to do something about my predicament rather than taking to my bed. It was real, I reminded myself. I needed to get my act together. For a start, I needed to find gainful employment. If I didn't, I was going to be in big trouble. I was capable of it, of course. After all, I'd once been editor of a glossy food and lifestyle magazine, the heart of the home, until they pulled it overnight 2 years ago and I was made redundant. Daniel had told me to take my time figuring out what to do next. "This is our time, now the kids have gone," he told me. "Don't force yourself to do anything you don't want to." I'd mistaken his generosity for kindness, not realizing it was guilt.
One Night at the Chateau by Veronica Henry is read by Imogen Stubbs and runs for 11 hours, 22 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And finally on today's show, a return to author of Electric Spark, Frances Wilson, for the Books of Her Life.
Is there a book you remember from your childhood that made you fall in love with the reading?
There were two books that completely kind of grabbed me as a child. One was Elaine Dundy's The Dud Avocado, which was the first book that made me feel so happy. I felt I was levitating. It was so full of joy. And that's actually also how reading a Spark novel makes you feel. And the other was Dodie Smith's I Capture the Castle, which just, it made me realise that a novel could completely sink into you and never go. It was an experience that you couldn't quite let go of.
You've really flung yourself into this, haven't you? In a way, it was exactly what I had been thinking too. And I was on the point of saying, into what? Very innocently, you know, so that he could tell me how different I was, how much I'd changed and so forth. But all at once, something stopped me. I knew I would have died rather than hear his reply. So instead I said, "Ah, well, don't we all?" which was my stock phrase when I couldn't think of anything else to say. There was a pause, and then he asked me how I was, and I said, "Fine, how was he?" And he said, "Fine," and I asked him what he was doing, and he said it would take too long to tell. It was then we both noticed we were standing right across the street from the Café Dupont, the one near the Sorbonne. "Shall we have a quick drink?" I heard him ask needlessly, for I was already halfway across the street in that direction. The café was very crowded, and the only place we could find was on the very edge of the pavement. We just managed to squeeze under the shade of the awning. A waiter came and took our order. Larry leant back into the hum and buzz and brouhaha and smiled lazily. Suddenly, without quite knowing why, I found I was very glad to have run into him. And this was odd, because two Americans re-encountering each other after a certain time in a foreign land are supposed to clamber up their nearest lampposts and wait tremblingly for it all to blow over. Especially me. I'd made a vow when I got over here never to speak to anyone I'd ever known before. Yet here we were, two Americans who hadn't really seen each other for years. Here was someone from home who knew me when, if you like, and instead of shambling back into the bushes like a startled rhino, I was absolutely thrilled at the whole idea.
I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. That is, my feet are in it. The rest of me is on the draining board, which I've padded with our dog's blanket and the tea cosy. I can't say that I'm really comfortable, and there is a depressing smell of carbolic soap, but this is the only part of the kitchen where there is any daylight left, and I have found that sitting in a place where you've never sat before can be inspiring. I wrote my very best poem while sitting on the hen house, though even that isn't a very good poem. I've decided my poetry is so bad that I mustn't write any more of it. Drips from the roof are plopping into the water butt by the back door. The view through the windows above the sink is excessively drear. Beyond the dank garden in the courtyard are the ruined walls on the edge of the moat. Beyond the moat, the boggy ploughed fields stretch to the leaden sky. I tell myself that all the rain we've had lately is good for nature, and that at any moment spring will surge on us. I try to see leaves on the trees and the courtyard filled with sunlight. Unfortunately, the more my mind's eye sees green and gold, the more drained of all colour does the twilight seem. It is comforting to look away from the windows and towards the kitchen fire, near which my sister Rose is ironing, though she obviously can't see properly, and it will be a pity if she scorches her only nightgown. I have two, but one is minus its behind.
The Dud Avocado by Elaine Dundy is available in audio commercially as narrated by Erin Bennett. And I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Candida Gubbins.
And what's your rainy day reread, your comfort read?
My comfort reread? Oh, it's the, I think it's anything by Nancy Mitford. is a comfort reread. I always laugh when I'm reading a Nancy Mitford novel.
Albert Gates came down from Oxford feeling that his life was behind him. The past alone was certain, the future strange and obscure in a way that it had never been until that very moment of stepping from the train at Paddington. All his movements until then had been mapped out unalterably in periods of term and holiday. There was never for him the question, what next? Never a moment's indecision as to how such a month or such a week would be spent. The death of his mother during his last year at Oxford, while it left him without any definite home ties, had made very little difference to the tenor of his life, which had continued as before to consist of terms and holidays. But now he stood upon the station platform faced, not with a day or two of uncertain plans, but with all his future before him a complete blank. He felt it to be an extraordinary situation and enjoyed the feeling. "I do not even know," he thought, "where I shall direct that taxicab." This was an affectation, as he had no serious intention of telling the taxi to go anywhere else than the Ritz, as indeed a moment later he did. On the way he pretended to himself that he was trying hard to concentrate on his future, but in fact he was, for the present, so much enjoying the sensation of being a sort of mental waif and stray, that he gave himself up entirely to that enjoyment. He knew that there would never be any danger for him of settling down to a life of idleness. The fear of being bored would soon drive him, as it had done so often in the past, to some sort of activity. Meanwhile, the Ritz. An hour later, he was sitting in that spiritual home of Oxonian youth, drinking a solitary cocktail and meditating on his own very considerable but diverse talents, when his best friend, Walter Monteith, came in through the swing doors with a girl called Sally Dalloch.
"Albert, darling," cried Sally, seeing him at once. "Easily the nicest person we could have met at this moment."
"How do you do, Sally?" said Albert, getting up. "What's the matter? Why are you so much out of breath?"
"Well, as a matter of fact, it's rather exciting, and we came here to find somebody we could tell about it. We've been getting engaged in a taxi."
"Is that why Walter's face is covered with red paint?"
"Oh, darling, look! Oh, the shame of it! Large red mouths all over your face! Thank goodness it was Albert we met, that's all!" cried Sally, rubbing his face with her handkerchief. "Here, lick that. There, it's mostly off now. Only a nice healthy flush left."
That's Katie Lung reading from Nancy Mitford's first novel, Highland Fling, which is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And is there something you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently is fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
I think it's a book by a young biographer. It was his first book, called Graham Watson. He's a young Scottish biographer, and it's called The Invention of Charlotte Bronte. You'd have thought that everything to be said about Charlotte Bronte had been said about her, but this is a really, really energetic and inspired spin on Charlotte Bronte's life, approaching it through her relationship with Elizabeth Gaskell, her first biographer, and I was dazzled by it.
"I am spoken of as an alien," Charlotte protested to the editor of the Christian Remembrancer that summer. She was responding to the latest in a spate of articles, contending the bitterness in her fiction had a root in her life, as reviewers noted similarities between Jane Eyre and Lucy Snow. They speculated on how such characters were produced, being so indifferent to moral perversity, the toleration of, nay, indifference to vice. They said their creator should have been improved by money, since she first appeared to the world as soured, coarse and grumbling, an alien, it might seem, from society, and amenable to none of its laws. Follett's moral campaign, they proposed, was to arouse sympathy for a debased class of woman that must embody much of the authoress's own feelings and experience. No personal disadvantages can hinder the unentitled sense of superiority this kind of woman expresses, they insisted, to demand room to expand, love, tenderness, and a place in happy domestic life. But in truth, she draws a character unfit for this home, which she yearns for. Without feelings of humble reverence for men, female characters such as Lucy Snow, and by implication Charlotte Bronte, cannot deserve the respect of a man, the reviewer concluded firmly. Extraordinarily, for one who had been recently so protective of her personal identity as to hide behind an assumed identity, Charlotte wrote to them under her own name to set the record straight, to explain precisely what kind of circumstances produced women in revolt like Jane Eyre and Lucy Snow. With a frankness she would at one time have only spoken through her characters, Charlotte spelled it out. Providence so regulated my destiny that I was born and have been reared in the seclusion of a country parsonage. I have never been rich enough to go out into the world as a participator in its gaieties, though it early became my duty to leave home in order partly to diminish the many calls on a limited income.
The Invention of Charlotte Bronte, Her Last Years and the Scandal That Made Her by Graham Watson is available in audio as read by Jane Entwistle, although it's not on any of the usual platforms, so you may have to do a bit of digging. And Frances Wilson, author of Electric Spark, The Enigma of Muriel Spark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show that was recorded on location at the Boswell Book Festival. Thanks once again to everyone at Dumfries House. If you want to listen back to anything or catch up with any number of the almost 500 episodes of Read On, which are available online, just search for R&IB Read On in your favourite podcast app. And I'll be back at the same time next week.
Books and accessible reading on R&IB Connect Radio.